is Hans Viggo Kristiansen, and I'm 43 years old. I was born in the south of Norway and studied in Oslo for 12 years, I think, all in all. And I'm a social anthropologist, so that's kind of my main identity in a way. And I did my field work in Santiago de Chile in 1993 and 1994. And I wrote a thesis on male homosexual identity in Chile, in the poor neighborhoods there mostly. And after that, I started to work at a research institute that's called NOVA, Norwegian Social Research, I think it's in English. And there I started to work on a large-scale research project on the living conditions of gay and lesbians in Norway. That was published in 1999, and it kind of made a lot of noise in a way, because the results, at least when it came to young people, were rather alarming. I think we found that one in four young person had, with the lesbian and gay identity, had tried to commit suicide. So the suicide numbers were really alarming in this sample that we gathered. But I think we had 3,000 gay and lesbian men and women answering this questionnaire. And then after that, we got a lot of media attention and so on with this report. And it also had an important impact in the debate in general here, because the gay and lesbian movement, they used the numbers strategically in a way to gain money for their work and so on. So it was, we had a lot of attention in the late 90s and early 2000s. And then after that, I started to work on my doctorate project, PhD project, on older gay men in a way. And so I did life story interviews with 23 men between, they were mostly in the 70s and 80s. And that was also a kind of social historical project where I focused on how their lives had been in 1950s and 1960s and all these kind of meeting places where they went, and the tea houses and the parks. And so that was a very interesting project, I think. And I defended that in 2004, where I got my PhD. And so after that, I got a new grant from the Norwegian Research Council to do a more broad social historical survey on the period between 1920 and the 1970s, in a way before Stonewall, before the Stonewall riots. And in this project, I used kind of an interesting methodology, because I very much went to the countryside, to focus on the countryside in the inland region. And there I did interviews both with older gay men and also some lesbian women, but mostly with the older heterosexuals who had grown up in small communities. And a lot of, many of them had things to tell about people they knew about, or couples, male-male or female-female couples that they knew about in their childhood. And so they got a lot of kind of indirect information about the conditions of homosexuality in the rural communities in Norway. So that was published in a book in 2008.
Well, I think that maybe that would be an interesting place to begin, if you could share with me some of this historical perspective of homosexuality from the 20s to the 70s. Mm. A lot of people have talked to me about homosexuality in Norway from the 50s on, and from the kind of formation of the gay and lesbian movement, the implementation of the law, of the groundbreaking legislation that has occurred here. But not too many people have focused on the living conditions of homosexuals around this time. So maybe if you could lead me slowly along this path, it would be very interesting.
Yeah, no, because my one of the main points I make in this book is that what I call the gay liberationist narrative on history, the kind of the history that has been told or had been created from the 1970s onwards, mostly by people within the gay and lesbian movement, has been very black and white in a way, has been very, and has often painted the period before the 1970s as a very sinister and dark era for homosexuals in general. And especially the countryside has been very many of them focused on the countryside as like the worst, the countryside in the past is like one of the worst places to be in a way for gay men and lesbian women. And so what kind of surprised me when I started to do these interviews was that many told me that there had been couples living in small villages in Norway, and everyone had known about them and in a way accepted them, with at least not giving them a hard time. And so my impression from these interviews have been that the level of acceptance towards same-sex sexuality has been greater than was than has been presented afterwards. So that this kind of narrative, the liberationist narrative that tries to kind of contrast the past to the present and the liberation of the present to the darkness, dark ages in a way, of the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, and 50s, especially. I think that's very exaggerated, and it has lost a lot of nuances in history.
Did that history told by the heterosexuals of their experiences of the past coincide with the experiences of the homosexuals?
Yes, in many ways, because at least this when I did this life story interviews with all the gay men who had the homosexual identity in the present, they also some of them were even nostalgic about the past. They said that 1950s were golden age in a way, because that was the time when there was a lot of meeting places and a lot of easy access to sexuality and to meeting other men in tea houses and in parks and public bathrooms and so on. But later on, and especially in the 1970s, all that kind of that infrastructure started to decay in a way, according to some of them. So
Could you be more precise and speak more in detail about these living circumstances and perhaps also these meeting places?
Mm.
Then I can maybe follow up later on how maybe the gay and lesbian movement might contribute to dissolving this that one. But
yeah, I don't really think they blame the gay and lesbian movement for dissolving them, but at least they say that the networks that existed, the male networks, that's what I'm mostly focused on. In the 1940s and 1950s, they were often very closed, that it was difficult to get into them, and that people met in private, mostly in private homes, in flats, and in dinner parties and so on, and that there was a very large degree of solidarity within this environment, so that when a young man had kind of been introduced to these networks, then he had a lot of friends and people helped each other, and that was a really nice environment to be in. And even though there was, of course, this law prohibiting same-sex sexuality until 1973, I think it was about abolished. A lot of them didn't know, or I never met anyone who has actually been punished, or have been known anyone else who have been kind of put into prison for same-sex sexuality. So it seems that law has been more or less a sleeping, I don't know if you use that as a sleeping law, or a law that's not been practiced. So I think the older homosexual men give very much the same impression as the straight people.
Why do you begin your research in the 1920s?
Well, that's because I mainly used oral sources for interviews, and that's how far you can get back in history with using oral sources. Because people who are not now in their 90s, they grew up in the 1920s or at least right. 1920s, so they can tell about that. But earlier than that, you can't reach with using that kind of sources.
What is that, it seems like you have focused on the oral narratives or the remembrances. What are the parallel narratives? By that I mean the medical narrative, the psychological narrative, the state narrative, the legal framework narrative, and so on. And how do they contrast to your results?
It's an important narrative in Norway has of course been the religious narrative, and the cultural narrative has been very much influenced by the religious narrative, and I think it's fair to say that homosexuality or same-sex sexuality was not thematized until maybe the 1950s within the church. People didn't talk much about it as a sin even, or it was just something that didn't exist in a way. So at least one researcher is called Halvor Moxnes. He's a theologian. He's argued that the situation before the mid-1950s was more or less a situation of silence when the church didn't talk about it. And it was only from the mid-1950s that they started to actively oppose homosexuality. And they defended the law against same-sex sexuality between men, and said that if we were to abolish that would be a great danger to humanity and stuff like that. So the church really entered into the discourse on sexuality first in the 1950s and onwards, and it was mostly very negative in a way, very. But that changed towards the 1970s, 1980s. So it got more, at least more accepting towards the persons. The church said that it didn't like the acts, but it could accepted the persons in a way. So and then in the 1990s, there was also gaining. More acceptance, so that also people, at least in parts of Norway, also priests can be live in relationships to other, or live in partnerships and or marriages to other persons of the same sex. So we have this same sex practicing priests also now in Norway. So the acceptance has been gradually growing. But what I'm interested in is also this silence that used to exist before the 1950s, and how did that silence in a way was enabling to persons, because when people didn't scandalize, didn't talk about it, it also gave possibilities for people to live this kind of discreet lives together, and also in the especially in the countryside. These couples, they live together as often as friends, just pretending to be friends. Or in one example, there's two women living together from the 1920s and the 1930s and so on. And one of them was the servant of the other. Or the one had owned her own farm and cattle and so on. Then the other came as a servant in her house, and all their life they lived together, in using that as a cover in a way. But people in this community told me that everyone knew actually they understood that the relationship was special between these two women, and they were also buried. When they were buried, they were buried under the same stone in the same way as married couples are. So I think that this kind of tacit acceptance of same-sex couples has been really a phenomenon that has not been given much attention, at least in the history that has been written by gay activists and so on from the 1970s onwards.
Is that silence related at all to fear? Is that a connection between, or not necessarily?
On the part of society towards homosexuals, you mean? Or
no, that silence from of the part of homosexuals towards society and the country. Mm-hmm. I mean, to choose to live a discreet, silent.
Yeah, that's part of it. At least the fear of, because to some of the older gay men I've interviewed, they were risking things. They were risking maybe their jobs and their careers, and they also some told that they had lost the flat when the landlord learned that there were a couple, male couple living there, and so there were of course fear related to it. But I think besides that, they also viewed discretion as a kind of a competency, as a way of something good a competency that was needed in order to avoid being scandalized or avoid being put in danger in a way. What I've been trying to describe is in a way this cultural discretion that existed among men in the 1940s and 1950s,
mm-hmm.
and really to understand how they thought about themselves, because what happened after the 1970s was that these discreet older men, they were very much scandalized in a way in within the gay subculture, and they were called things like closet queens and seen as a cowardly and why don't they come out and things like that. And I've tried to maybe do a little bit more justice to their own way or to their way of understanding themselves and especially this cultural discretion that used to exist. And I think it's not so, I don't mean that it's preferable to the present situation and that people should be discreet today and that but I think it's important to understand it within the context of within the historical context, really, how to understand how society was at this time and also to give them credit in a way for being able to live if not openly but at least to live homosexual lives in this period and to adjust themselves to the conditions they were living under. So, for instance, there's this one couple that is one of my favorite examples. They lived in Oslo and they came from like middle upper class families. And this couple, the two men, they used to live with a mother and aunt of one of them. They shared a flat. Not a very large flat, but in this flat, these two men they lived in a maid's room and in bunk beds. I think for more than 20 years they lived together with the mother and aunt without ever talking about homosexuality or really discussing their relationship as a homosexual relationship.
To the
mother and aunt. So they just. And this one man, Alpha, I call him, that I talked to, he said that he was very, he thought that this was a good thing, that he felt that his mother had known all along, but that they never made it explicit. It was like a silent complicity in a way that that made it possible for them to live together without having to talk about it, and to thematize it and to make it into topic in a way. So I think that kind of arrangements was common in the 1950s
which presupposes that they could have no physical interaction in public. holding hands or hugging or.
Yeah, that's true, and so he said that explicitly, that that the only time that they hugged each other was on New Year's Eve in these parties, because they had mostly heterosexual friends, and then in the party on New Year's Eve they could hug each other, because then everyone else also did. So in the public they just acted as friends, but at the same time their friends, their heterosexual friends, they treated them as a couple in a way. So they always invited them as Alf and Carl, where they kind of the names I've given them, and so they were also always kind of talked about as a couple in a way, or as a concept, the two of them together. So they also, even though they never discuss homosexuality with their friends or kind of never came out as a gay couple, they felt that the friends accepted them as such. You know. So also in relation to friends, they had this kind of silent complicity that everyone knew, but no one talked about it. So.
It's when I was growing up, in Colombia, I had a few friends from maybe two generations above me, and I remember them always telling me something that I criticized loudly afterwards, that sexuality was something that only happened in bed, like that they should never be discussing their sexual orientation with anyone, because it was something. Was this culture of being discreet in essence. And but I always felt that was so antithetical to the way I wanted to live my life. So I'm curious about how you understand this this concealment as a form of having a good life in that historical context.
Yeah, because I think that if we think of what would happen if they had kind of come out to the mother and aunt of this. This one man, for instance, what would have happened if they had kind of come out to their friends and families at that time? And I think that, or at least they themselves thought that it would have had very damaging consequences to them in a way. So that this separation between the private life in a way and the public image, that it was a strategy to survive in a way. Not that they had been killed, but at least they would have had probably difficulties with work and with maybe also with some of their friends. And if they had been, if they had in a way forced their friends or family to acknowledge them openly with and not only silently. So, I think it's a good point that, and also I think it's important that they, at least the one man that I talked to, his partner was dead, the one man Alf, he was very, he stressed that they had a loving relationship, that they really loved each other, and they had a very good life together, and that it was not only the sexual part that had been important, but also the friendship and the love in that relationship. So I think in a way that we have to understand it as a way of, as kind of a competency or a way of managing a difficult situation. I think it's especially within the problems or the discussions that really arise within the gay and lesbian movement, because also there you had this kind of generation shift that took place in the early 1970s, I would say, from the very discreet founders of the gay and lesbian movement in Norway, because it started there really in 1950 with Rolf Løvaas and some of his friends that really started the gay and lesbian movement. And after him, there was a guy called Dermot Mock, who was also very, very discreet about his sexual life. And he always used a pseudonym, he said, cover-up names and so on, you know, in public. And then he did that all his life also when he grew old. And when they wrote in the newspapers and so on, they used pseudonyms, and they had So they used kind of this way of discrete resistance in a way towards the government but at the same time they did a lot of important things because they did like lobby towards the politicians and so on to decriminalize homosexuality, and they also made the facilitated meeting places for women and men. And they even wrote this book, We Who Feel Differently, that came in 1954, I think, 53 or 54. That was very, very important to many people. But later, or in the 1970s and 1980s, all the work done by the gay and lesbian movement in the 1950s and 1960s were like discharged.
Discarded,
that's the word. And also made invisible by the new people, because it was said that it was called cowardly, and why didn't they come out in the 1950s, and why didn't they do like we do now in the 1970s and 1980s? So I think a lot of the kind of the founding people within the movement, they felt very, they felt a little bit betrayed by the new leadership, because they didn't get recognition really for the work they had done.
Do they now?
Hardly. I think it is beginning to be published articles and things like that about their work, but I think still it's the discourse of the gay and lesbian movement of the 1970s and 80s and 90s has really buried them in a way, so that they are and now they also, most of them are dead, and they don't but there were problems, because even though the gay and lesbian movement, like Kjell Erik Øye, for instance, he was one who tried really to acknowledge them, and he tried to bring some of them into the public attention in a way. But at the same time, since they wanted to be discreet and didn't want to show up in public and receive prizes and stuff like that, they it was difficult also to give them the recognition they deserved.
Oh, so they continued to want to be discreet?
Yes, even in their old age.
Oh, okay.
Some of them. Others, like Arne Heli, for instance, he was very open in his later years, in his from the mid 1990s and until he died in 2006. He was very outspoken, representative of the older generation in a way of the gay and lesbian movement, and he was very critical of Kim Friele, for instance, and the persons that came in the late 60s and 70s. And there was very, very harsh discussions really between these persons.
Did you have a chance to speak to any of them about this decision of remaining to be discreet even after they had been outed publicly?
I don't think they were outed really. No. Like I never got to talk to the founding, like the Rolf Løvaas and Helmut Mack, because they were the first leaders in a way. Because they died before I had the time to interview them. And I think also Rolf Løvaas, who was the first chairman in a way of the organization, he in his old years he wrote with his own name and was more open in a way. So,
but how do you understand this decision?
Well, I think it has to do with habit really, and the way you are. They were like they had when they grew up in a way, they were socialized into this culture of discretion, and they learned the competency of not doing that, not being obvious and not exposing themselves. And I think that it's hard to change a thing like that when you are in your 50s, 60s, and 70s. It's kind of the norms and the culture you are socialized into that will, in a way, put this mark on you in a way, and so I think that's part of the, because they didn't run any risks anymore, and in a way they couldn't, or at least not, not so many big risks when they were in the old age.
Yeah, but it's the way that they had projected themselves and lived their lives.
That it had left a mark on them in a way that it was hard to change.
Yeah. I would like to go back to speaking about the issues of community and meeting places, and maybe there weren't any bars, but there must have been some kind of public gatherings. And could you speak about all of these places in which these homosexual activities were taking place, if you will?
Yeah, when I started to do my field work, in a way, I had to go to pubs in a way, to the bars that exist presently in a way, and especially early in the afternoon, I met people there. I met these kind of groups of older gay men who met in, let's say, from 3 o'clock to 6-7 p.m. in the afternoon, and then afterwards they left the bar. So when the younger people started to come, they were not there. But at least in this group, they had a lot of jokes and a lot of stories about the tea houses and the public toilets. In Oslo in the 1950s and 60s, and I think it was a lot of folklore and a lot of stories and a lot of jokes and stuff like that about these meeting places and what went on there and the names they used on them and so on. So I started to ask about that in the interviews and try to make a map in a way of Oslo and the male homosexual infrastructure of Oslo in the 1950s, and that was very, very interesting. And of course, there were lots of these tea houses or public toilets, especially underground. They had went down downstairs in a way, and it was they were often quite dark, and so that people could get into contact with each other there. And often they also told me that, especially in the east end of Oslo, that they also went there to meet straight men in a way, non-homosexual men or non-gay identified men, especially from the working class and like people working at the docks and manual workers and things like that. And they said that it was possible for men at that time to have sexual contacts also with men who didn't identify as homosexuals in these places, in these tea rooms and things like that. So
the tea room is also a place for sexual encounter. It's not what it sounds in its name, a place of conversation, is it?
Yes, it was mostly a place for silent sexual encounters, really, not for conversations, but after people had met there, maybe they could talk up on the street, and that was also interesting because very many of the men who had later come in or been able to find friendship networks. So the way into the friendship networks often was went through these encounters on the toilets. So they met someone there, and then they maybe talked to them afterwards, and thereby we were introduced to friends and invited to parties and so on. So that was kind of the entry point very often into these very hidden networks. In that sense, it played a very important role in I also think that the founders of the gay and lesbian organization, they were mostly men. And I think that was the way they got together originally, that they met in restrooms and in the environment around the toilets and parks, and then after some time, the network was formed in a way on the basis of such relationships.
And this is a network, I imagine, that takes place or is constructed via word of mouth.
Yeah, of course, and also there were some articles in the 1950s about scandalizing in a way what went on these toilets and some stories about lewd behavior in a way in public toilets, and that of course made them attractive to more people but there were of course a lot of rumors about what places to visit and so on, and And also some of the men told that they had the kind of rounds. They went from one place to another, and could, if they started maybe at 9 o'clock in the afternoon, they could visit 10 or 15 public toilets in one night. And so if they went to one and there was no one there, they could go to another one, another one, etc. And I think the most popular places were the ones situated close to parks and green areas, so that people could go and meet or start a contact in a way at the toilet, and then they could walk into the park afterwards and maybe have sexual relationships there. So it was, and also the Frogner Park in Oslo, I don't know if you have seen it, the sculpture park. That was also very important in the 1950s as a meeting place, especially in the at the back there. It used to be much more trees and bushes and stuff like that in that time. So that was a very, very important place to meet.
Do you have any stories about these kind of meeting places before the 1950s, from the 20s to the 50s?
Yes, at least from the 19 or the older homosexual men, they told also from the 1940s, and there are also descriptions from the 1930s, but I have not gathered oral history from the 30s, but from the 40s, and also from the German occupation. At least three or four of the ones that I interviewed, they told that they had sexual relations with German soldiers, or at least recruiting German soldiers at these toilets in the 1940s. But I think that goes back a long time, at least till the second half of the 19th century. So, mm-hmm. So I think because they have been, these toilets have been there for a long time, and I think they've probably been in use also for that purpose for far back. I think some of the historians who have written about this older period also mentions court cases and stuff like that connected to people being arrested at toilets and so on. So it has been known
from these accounts. When do the first official gay places open? Is it sometime in the 60s or?
What do you mean by official?
Well, like a gay bar that is labeled as such.
I think that would be the 1960s, maybe also the late 1960s, the first like official gay place had to be the association of 1948, or the Gay and Lesbian Association, and they had parties, and they had also started their own club after some time. And that was in the 1970s. But then also in the 1960s, there were bars that were kind of known to be meeting places for men who have sex with men, or you could cruise other men. But they were not, they were just ordinary bars in a way, with a high percentage of homosexual clients in a way. So those kind of bars existed also in the 1950s and 1960s. But they were not gay bars in a way, they were not identified as such, but they were places where you can go and where you could meet other men. But I think that the first really official place that must have been, I think, in the early 1970s that they started to organize more like the bars we know now, the gay bars and clubs.
That goes along with the politicization of sexual orientation in a way.
Yes, in a way, that the post-Stonewall approach in a way, but also in the 1950s, the Association of 1948, that was also like a very discreet name in a way, because it doesn't tell you very much, it's just a year.
Why is it called like this?
No, because it was in Norway, it was started in 1950, but in Denmark it was really the first It was started up in Denmark in by Axel Axgill or Axel Monsen was his real name, and so the Norwegian Association, it started really as a branch of the Danish Association. So that was, even though it started in 1950, they used the Danish name, so they call it the Norwegian Association of 1948. That was at least what it was, the name that was going to, it got in the 1950s. But I think the reason why the Danes used it was that it was like a discreet name. It was a, they didn't say the Homosexual Association of 1948, but just that's association. Yeah, so it was a way to camouflage it in a way. But at least in Norway, that name, after it was used in press and so on, it very soon people associated it with homosexuality. So therefore, they also used some other names. For instance, the Association for City and Countryside, or something like that, when they wanted to rent a house or use, so they used these kind of discrete names to protect the members in a way. And but they had these parties, maybe once a month or twice a month for members, and but they were very careful so that people from the outside would not know about it, and try to protect their members. And that's probably something Kim Friedli can tell you about, because when she tried to get into the association, but she was rejected at the door in a way, because they didn't know that that she was a lesbian woman. They probably thought she was a school mistress or something like that, or maybe someone annoyed with her, what went on there. So she was, and that's kind of a very famous passage.
At the time, it was only for homosexual men.
No, also for women, but you had to be a member, or you had to be recommended by a member to get in there. So if you just showed up at the door, that you would probably not let you in. And that was what happened to her, and so she writes very bitterly about that in one of her books, her meeting with a kind of this discreet generation of the association in 1948.
Once there is a place in which a sense of community is built up, there is a kind of perception of it as a group or a sense of community. Is that a place in which perhaps the idea of being discreet starts to be rejected?
Yeah, that might be so, but of course that depends on what happens in society at large, I think, because of the international development and the things that went on in the United States and other places. The climate around homosexuality was getting warmer in a way, or more friendly. If the development had gone the opposite way, maybe, and that it had become more repressive, and more maybe the religious groups had gained more power and stuff like that, I think that they would have had to continue to meet in discrete places. But I think it was very important in community building that people had the chance to meet in secret in a way, or to build up networks between themselves, and also the networks between lesbian women and gay men, because that was really started really in the 1950s, in these meetings that they had and the parties and this kind of closed enclave in a way that they created. And I think it would have been very difficult to take the next step in a way to start building a community more broadly if you hadn't had this kind of build-up period when people could build their identity and kind of build up consciousness. So that's also one of the things that I think is often not taken into account, that this was in these discrete meetings were also important as a step towards the liberation that came in the 1970s. And that they really did an important job in kind of getting people together and making it possible for people to be homosexual at least, or to be open at least within this these closed walls in a way, so that it was important to individuals, and also that these individuals later made it possible to take the next step in a way towards more liberationist stance.
So it seems like through your work you're highlighting the roots or a kind of neglected history of the movement. Why do you think there was such an adamant opposition to that, as opposed to understanding that perhaps the situation in society was such that it didn't permit for a louder way of expressing? Why take on a dismissive attitude as opposed to an embracing one from the political association?
I don't know really what was, part of it was maybe personal conflicts also, when these leaders, the new generation of leaders, they got like in they got into personal conflicts also with the old leadership in a way, and that might have contributed, but I think also is part of every kind of liberationist ideology, that it's difficult to build up a historical narrative without contrasting the liberated present to the unliberated and dark past in a way, so that it's in order to further a political agenda towards gay liberation, you in a way had to make this kind of contrast between the past and the present. And I think it's also a part of it has to do with the generations and generation conflicts between generations, and that the new generation that took over in the late 60s and 1970s, they wanted to build something new. They wanted to really to do something that was different from what had been done previously, and they wanted a new, fresh start in a way. And in order to do that, they had to, or at least they did, discharge or didn't. Discard, what was that word? the work of the earlier generation. So I think that's at least part of the explanation.
Then these changes start to occur. The decriminalization later on, and the anti-discrimination law, the partnership law, and so on and so forth to the present. How do you see the way that this legislation affected people's lives? And the way that they perceive themselves in relationship to this earlier historical account that you are narrating?
Yes, of course. I think what happened in the 1970s, at least to the association of 1948, is that they grew very much in membership, and a lot of young people started to get. Get into the organizations, and so I think they had more than 1,000 members in the mid 1970s. While in the 1950s they had maybe 50, 60 members. So that was one to work for gay rights and to work for within such organizations that became much more and dangerous in a way, or not so dangerous, it's also difficult as it used to be. So I think that's at least one change. And but at the same time, the some of the men I interviewed, they hadn't really known that there existed a law in the 1950s, and they were not really conscious that it was prohibited at all. So I don't think it should be over. It should be exaggerated too much, the existence of a law like that. And you also see also often in countries today where homosexuality is prohibited that you might have a very lively gay scene, and you might have a lot of people living openly as homosexuals, even though you have the law there. So I think that there's no really one-to-one relationship between decriminalization and liberation in a way, but probably to a lot of people it made it less, took out some of the nervousness or the concerns they had to be punished. But at the same time, I think, the guy we mentioned earlier, Runar Jordan, and also a historian called Holsos, they have both written about the practice of the law in the 1930s and 40s and 50s. And they have found very, very few cases, and most of the cases that were prosecuted under this law, the paragraph 213, they were also additional things, and maybe they had relationship with minors or some kind of rape-like relation involved. So, or maybe very large age difference and things like that. So I think they've concluded that this law very, very rarely applied to just ordinary male sex, same-sex relationships or relations. So it was mostly when it was done in public or something like that they used this law.
I have a sense from certain suggestions in the way that you're talking about this, that you seem to want to differentiate or not over exaggerate the impact of legislation and political action over the cultural development of these issues. Is that so?
Yes, I think that's true, and that I think it's important to see the changes in a larger perspective and also in international perspective, because these changes took place in very many countries at the same time in Europe and North America and so on. And I think often the view of the gay and lesbian movement has been a little bit nearsighted, that it was only because of their efforts and their work and their fight that these changes came about. And I don't think that's the case, really, even though it has, of course, had some impact. But for instance, there was also in the Norwegian law, there was also this paragraph prohibiting sex with animals. That was kind of in the same clause in a way as sex between men, and that was also abolished at the same time in 1972 or 73, and there was of course no pressure group working for that. So it was really the abolition of the law in Norway was very much a part of the modernization of the legal system, and not only a result of the work of the gay and lesbian movement.
But how would you relate that to, for example, the partnership law or the marriage act, which seemed to be achieved out of this hardcore lobbying and kind of political insistence and determination, which also seemed to affect the way that people are living their lives currently? Would you say that is that, yeah, how do you position yourself in relationship to this?
Well, that's also a very interesting thing, because that's also very parallel things happening in many different countries at the same time, both in Denmark, Sweden, and Norway, and very much the same kinds of laws being implemented in these places more or less at the same time. So of course it's been I think the lesbian and gay movement have been instrumental in putting these issues on the agenda, and have kind of been important in that sense. But I think really that it is important also to take into account that there's been in Norway and in Scandinavia this kind of tradition of partnerships that goes way back. It goes back into the 1920s and 1930s and so on, where people have been living together discreetly without sanctions from the law, and that I think also that traditional the tradition of same-sex relationships has kind of deep roots in the culture and in history in Norway, and that is also important to take into account, not only the lobbying and the work of the gay and lesbian movement.
Of course, but it is this sanctioning that makes relationships be realized in a fuller way, in the sense that you can visit your partner if he's dying and so on, and you know, things that other people would have had to conceal. So yeah. I suppose it's a parallel, intertwined relationship that cannot be both the lobbying and the cultural natural cultural development, I suppose, right?
Yeah, and that's very important. And I've had some conversations with some of the, my informants or the men participants in my doctoral thesis, and because some couples, older couples, that's often very important to get to formalize the relationship, because I've heard just lots of sad stories about kind of couples where the who have been living together very discreetly in for years and years, and then the older party dies, and the other one is left with nothing in a way, because the family of the deceased inherit everything, and they might not even know that the other has been his lifetime companion. So I actually urged some of the people I talked to formalize their relationship, and some have done that. And it's always to some of the couples who have been together like for 40 years and met each other in the 1950s, 1960s, it might be a little bit difficult to use these laws, because or at least they feel that would imply that they go then publicize their relationship in a way, that they register their relationship, and they are a little bit afraid to do that, because they want to keep on living together, but in a discreet way. So I think maybe this, although some all the gay couples register and marry and things like that, it's I think they are, or the they are not fully able to take advantage of the new opportunities that come, because
this quite discreetness is something that I have encountered a lot since I arrived here, especially because I was talking to some people to understand a bit how the gay scene works in Gayseer and other platforms like that, and there is even the idea of being discreet and not showing the face, and is something that persists amply, I would say. Why have you thought about this, as this idea of discreteness relates to the contemporary setting, and if so, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's very interesting, and that you bring up the internet and this kind of new meeting places, and in a way, I think the internet has taken over very much of the role that the tea houses and the toilets had in for the previous generations. So I think that's important. There are kind of two things, because I think the discreetness, it has also to do with the phase of life you are in, because I think a lot of young people who are kind of exploring their sexuality a little, and they don't want to identify as gay or lesbian or bisexual, but they want to kind of use these venues in a way to explore the sexuality and maybe find out more about themselves without having to identify as gay or being very explicit about what they are. So I think that's part of it, at least that young people and people a little bit uncertain about their sexuality, they can use this as a tool in a way to try different to try out their sexuality. So I think that's one part of it, and also I think there are of course minorities within Norway, minority groups that are more where same-sex sexuality is more stigmatized than others, and like for instance we have kind of large Muslim population in Norway, and I think a lot of people from such ethnic minorities, they would like to be discreet or to maintain a discreet face in a way, or to be able to live sexually without having to be publicly gay. So I think that's also might be one explanation why you find discretion like that today.
So it seems to me that you tend to be opposed to the narrative of repression. To speak about this overarching cultural repression on the community. Is that so? I mean, in relationship, for example, to this issue of discreteness.
Well, I don't know if I would say that as such, but I think at least what I've tried to do is to get to make the historical narrative more nuanced, to get more to see that it's not been a development from black to white, to from darkness to light in a way, but that used to be a lot of maybe light spots also in the past and dark spots in the present.
Mm-hmm.
So that this very dichotomous view of history, that's I think that has been one of the issues in a way that I have tried to, or the points I tried to make in my book.
Mm-hmm.
So, but of course the I think it's also important not to minimize or to trivialize the repression that people have experienced in their lives, because there are of course people who experience hardship and even violence and death even today and as in the past. So I think it's important to take that seriously, but at the same time recognize really the bravery and maybe the accomplishment that it was also in the 1950s to be able to live with a partner, even if you lived discreetly and hiding it from the larger society. That was kind of an achievement in that, and that should be acknowledged today. So I think that's if I have a main point in my my research, I think
right.
That would be it. That's, it should not be so black and white. I think it's also important, or in the book at least, I focus a little bit on the perception of the rural, of the countryside in a way, because I think that in very much research that have been done on the history and also on the present situation of lesbians and gay men, the countryside has also been like the contrast to the city, and that a lot of researchers from North America, for instance, they are focused on that the homosexual life is only possible in big cities, and so that's also the thing that I've tried to problematize a little bit, and by focusing on these stories about same-sex couples living in the countryside and often also living happily in the countryside, and I think that's also a part of the view of homosexual life that has to be revised, or at least nuanced a bit, because that's also my own experience from living here in Norway, because I spent 5 years I think in a very small rural community in the inner part of Norway. And my partner, he worked as a priest there, and he was the parish priest, and we had no one reacted badly to us, and we were very well treated there, and met with friendliness and very large, very much acceptance. And that was a little bit contrary to what I had expected, because I really expected that when you move to the countryside, you will be arrest, and people have very traditional views, and they are more backward than people in the cities, and you don't know where to meet other people, and all that turned out to be wrong in a way. So I think also that personal experience I've had from living in small the countryside in Norway has had an impact on how I view the past, and that there might be some parts, some corners of the past that has to be revisited in order to see, has it really been so hard, and has it really been so difficult for people.
Are you interested in the conditions, the contemporary conditions, both in the city and the rural spaces? Is that something that you're working on now?
Yes, I think now I'm working very much within the field of health promotion and more like health-related issues, and I think also that's an important part of it, and I think that is often overlooked how people live in the countryside, and we take for granted that it's hard that people move from there, they move to the city when they're growing up, and find the identity, they move to the city. The, for instance, here close to Gjøvik, a place called COP, they have this very interesting meeting places for transgendered persons. Meet in a, I think it's a woman there who used to sell this kind of implants for women who had breast cancer, you know, and she has started to have a lot of clients transgendered clients who also wanted these implants and or I don't know what they call it, the things you put on the outside. And also to learn how to do makeup and stuff like that. So they had this really resource center for transgender persons in a small community here close to Gjøvik. And that's also some things, stories like that, that you don't hear very often in the gay media and in the, and also in the mainstream media. That is, I think there's a lot of lack of knowledge about the rural part of Norway, at least. And we take for granted that people are repressed in a way when they live outside big cities.
Yeah, well, it's, sometimes it's not the case. Yeah.
Yes, I think that it's many examples, at least to the contrary, and that it's a part of it's a prejudice in a way that we think that it's only possible to live homosexual life in a big city. So you get like a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way that because you think that it's impossible, people move before they try.